It may be invisible to some or ever-present to others, but trauma entangles us all. Welcome to Traumatize, brought to you by Volare. Traumatize is a podcast that creates space and conversations to untangle the societal knots that keep us from addressing trauma after crime. For you, we want this podcast to be an experience, one where you leave understanding how you can be a crossing point to minimize the deeply painful and costly consequences of trauma, no matter who you are.
Welcome back to Traumatize, where we believe trauma is a common thread of the human connection. I'm Bridget Stump, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Lindsay Silverberg.
Today, we are honored to be joined by Patrice Sultan. Patrice is the executive director of the Center on Race, Inequality, and the Law at NYU School of Law. She is an attorney, professor, and nationally recognized criminal justice reform advocate who has spent her career fundamentally reimagining how we think about who we punish, why we punish, and how we punish. Before joining NYU, Patrice founded and led DC Justice Lab, an innovative nonprofit driving large-scale reforms to Washington, D.C.'s criminal legal system. She has represented clients in criminal and civil cases and has worked alongside grassroots organizations in communities deeply impacted by over-policing, over-sentencing, and unsafe jail conditions.
Patrice has worked at the forefront of efforts to transform how communities approach public safety and justice. And at the same time, she teaches and trains the next generation of advocates, grounding her work in both community-rooted experience and legal expertise. In this episode, we'll talk about trauma inside the criminal legal system, what it means to redefine public safety, and how the law can be used not just to punish, but also to repair and transform. Patrice, thanks so much for joining us.
I am such a fan of the pod. Thank you for letting me be here.
Well, Patrice, we're really excited to have you here. And this season, we have been focusing on champions of change who are really actively trying to reshape systems to be more trauma responsive. And we really couldn't have thought of anybody better than you to bring on to talk about that. So we would love for you to tell our listeners, when you think about the criminal legal system, where do you see trauma embedded in the structure of the system itself?
Unfortunately, I see it embedded at every point of interception in our system. We have developed a system that reflexively punishes people because that's what's easiest to draft and easiest for people to think about. And sometimes the easiest solution is the one that puts us in a worse position than we would have been in otherwise. So we see violence at every stage, including arrest, the conditions within which people live in our jails and prisons, and even the way we prosecute cases from start to finish. And that's not exclusively focused on the person who's been accused. We see quite a bit of dehumanization happening toward the person who was harmed in the first place, witnesses who were involved in these cases. And even sometimes we're insensitive to the trauma that our jurors experience as they're asked to be fact finders in these cases along the way.
Oh, I love that you just mentioned the jury experience. We were just having a conversation with our staff about this. Someone had been called to voir dire, and we were talking about how a lot of folks go into that doing their civic duty, not realizing they might themselves be asked about their own trauma exposure and experiences and the way that that's asked. And again, this is like not at all connected to the underlying cases that are relevant in the process, but I think there's just so much that's misunderstood about the way even the procedures of the legal systems have been designed to not center people. And so you're just bringing so much up for me already, Patrice. And of course, I know that you've worked in the trenches, you've been a defense attorney, and then, you know, used a lot of that practical experience being a practitioner as a legislative drafter, rewriting the entire criminal code. For folks who are like, what does that mean? It's basically working no small miracle. And now you're a leader of a National Racial Justice Center at NYU. How has your understanding of harm shifted as you've moved from representing individuals to kind of working at this higher level, redesigning systems?
When we think about systems, a lot of what we're asking lawmakers and others to do is to draw lines, to create categories around people, create categories around offense type, create categories around circumstances. And it's very difficult to do that in a way that accounts for every kind of harm and for the agency of each person who was involved in an individual case. So what I've learned is that when we're undertaking that kind of exercise, we should be really thoughtful about the difference between what we authorize, what we leave to discretion, and what we inflict mandatorily. And the more room we can leave for choice and agency and nuance, the better off we usually are. So I try to write with that in mind.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, I think a lot of the public safety conversations are framed, right, when we think about the criminal legal system around punishment and control. And one of the things I so admire about you is you've pushed us to really rethink what safety actually means. And so I think one of the things that I'd love to know is, like, from your perspective, what does trauma-informed public safety actually look like?
When I hear the phrase trauma-informed, I think sometimes it conjures up notions of being really gentle and soft-spoken and patient. But to me, it's like any other lens where what we're trying to do is recognize people's humanity. And when we think about catering to people's express interests, particularly as lawyers and advocates, we have to appreciate the fact that what people ask and what they decide is shaped by their experience, their knowledge, their circumstances. And it isn't enough to just give someone a binary choice. Do you want this thing or do you want that thing? You really have to make sure that they're making knowing, intelligent, and voluntary decisions. And that means accounting for things, including the trauma that they've experienced over the course of their lives. And it gets more and more complicated, as you all know well, when you have multiple people involved with multiple kinds of experience that they're bringing to a single case or circumstance. So just being thoughtful about that, to me, is what trauma-informed public safety means.
I was just going to say, I think what's so poignant for me about that is it's not just the parties, right? Like the person who caused harm and maybe the person experienced it. But to your point, it's like also the system actors that are participating in it. Because as Bridget and I talk about probably ad nauseum, is that we know over 70% of adults in the U.S. have experienced one traumatic event in their life, and that that shapes the way, right, that they interact and probably either reinforce or engage with if they're the system actor. And what I mean by that, right, is the person who is maybe enforcing the rules or giving this like binary choice, and how important it is for those of us in those roles to really like examine that and see where, get curious about where there is more opportunity, I think, to give different options, to give more than two options, or where our own biases might be playing into what we're deeming is like the only choice for public safety.
Yeah, Patrice, you've worked really closely with communities that have been over-policed and over-sentenced, and kind of by design, when we talk about how the criminal legal system was really built, I think in a lot of ways to cause harm, right? Like you talked about this kind of punitive response, often unfettered in the ways it's applied fairly and justly in specific communities. And I really want to know for you, what does it feel like to carry, you know, those kind of lived experiences that you've had into rooms of power? And how do you kind of navigate the tension of now holding power to transform systems, but recognizing how that often has been used sometimes to cause harm? And what's that balance look like for you?
I really tried to pull people back to a common sense understanding of how we think about punishment. We think about it in so many other contexts, from parenting to teaching to any kind of group activity, really. And we normally understand that there is such a thing as over-punishment, as inflicting so much pain that you're actually not making behavior better, you're making it worse. But in the throes of a really difficult situation where there's a lot of hurt and a lot of pain on one side of the equation, we tend to put that out of our minds or forget about it temporarily. And so just being able to say, let's take a 30,000 foot view of a situation and understand what we're doing system-wide and what impact that's going to have is a lot of the role I try to play. And what I'm finding is a theme is that oftentimes in individual fact patterns, we're looking at, was this action justified? Was this legally authorized? And when we talk amongst ourselves about kind of common sense solutions and problem solving, we usually are asking, was this preventable? Was this necessary? Is there something we could actually do better? And that reframe is something I try to bring to rulemaking bodies and others that are so entrenched in sort of how we've already decided the rules are going to be that we've lost sight of how things could be or should be or operate in other domains.
Ooh, that's like a hard space to sort of get people to step back out of, right? Because one, it means they have to admit they made an assumption or maybe it was wrong, right? And so that's got to be a challenging space to sort of operate in. And I'm sure that you're incredible at it because, you know, as we know, you teach future lawyers. And so what do you do? Like, what is the mindset shift that you do most when you want your students to leave with when they're thinking about justice and punishment?
One theme that comes up for me a lot is the meaning of individual words that we sort of take for granted. And now that I'm working on broader racial justice issues, the word that I'm digging into the most is dangerousness. We see this at every point in the criminal legal system where we're making evaluations about whether a person is or is not dangerous. We don't always give that a lot of thought. Without giving it a lot of thought, bias creeps in, racial animus creeps in, and really unequal outcomes creep in. And so to think about the propensity or potential for future harm or the risk of danger is very different than thinking about which tropes or stereotypes do we think of when we think of a dangerous person. And that's something I really like to push through exercises that I do with students. I think it's really interesting to force them to think about dangerousness through a different kind of fact pattern than the ones we're used to seeing on TV for the decades before we get to law school.
Yeah, it's so important, I think, to be aware of our own biases that are going to shape what we feel, right? And what's coming up for me, Patrice, is when we talk about the neuroscience of trauma, a lot of times this subjective determination that like that person feels dangerous for me or I'm observing this as danger is so deeply tied to like our own prior experiences and our brain kind of scanning for what feels safe, what we've been taught to think means safety and what doesn't. And so much of that is not real, right? It's all constructed. And so I love the way you're thinking about bringing that to your students. And it's a hopeful place to be able to see people being really nuanced and thoughtful about system reform and that you're really driving that conversation. You know, of course, the work that you've done, the stakes are incredibly high when you think about loss of liberty, right? Incarceration, the racial inequities that communities face intersecting with these systems and just how it perpetuates just generational harm over and over again. And then overall, like just how these things really prevent us from actually accessing public safety and restoration. These are big, big things that we don't want to make light of. And of course, like it's hard work. And I want to know, in doing all of this, what has kept you hopeful? Where have you been able to see kind of resiliency break through these really high stakes, hard topics and experiences?
I love that you mentioned the generational piece because I think sometimes we can zero in on individual trauma and forget that there's the sort of year over year, the mass trauma and, you know, the concentration of trauma in specific locales. And I think that's really important. And similarly, we find community at each of those levels. We see community among people who live in the same area, who have lived through the same experience, who are tied together by their generation to which they belong. And I really find a lot of hope in the kind of base building work that we've seen get us through difficult periods of history like this one. And the community and base building that I've seen get people through really difficult times in other parts of the world. So I think the more I can spend time listening and learning from things that have actually happened, the more hopeful I feel, as opposed to just trying to imagine something as if we've never been able to get people to see right as right and wrong as wrong.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. You know, I, of course, like reform efforts, especially that focus on this incremental change, are long and slow. And you've tried to really push for sweeping structural shifts. I'm just thinking about the work we saw you doing really closely here in the district. And what makes this bold reform possible? And what also do you think tends to hold us back from progress?
I love this question. I actually think bold change is easier than tinkering around the edges. My experience has been that when you do something that people can see the meaning of, they get more excited more quickly. An example of this is working on the criminal record sealing and expungement statute in DC. There had been about 15 years of people wanting to make one change to one part of one subsection or another change to another part of one subsection. And when we worked with people who were living with criminal records and said, we're just going to rewrite the whole chapter with them, it took less than 24 hours for a majority of the council to sign on to that version of reform because it was more understandable. It was clear that it was actually going to meet the need and address the underlying complaint. And I think people latch on to things when they understand that it's actually going to affect change and get a little bit apathetic when it feels small and incremental. So that's been my experience so far, even though it might be a little bit counterintuitive to think about it that way. I think going big works better.
That's fascinating. I'm just thinking about it with our experience around mandated reporting and how often it's incremental. And then it also creates chaos, right? Because it's not this big sweeping change. And so pieces of the legislation, they don't work together in practice. And that is really interesting. It does feel like oftentimes maybe the appetite seems like it's more for the small little changes because those feel easier. But I like that. I mean, it makes sense. It seems like that was true of the criminal reform work that you did, even though that was a hard and long process, that the big sweeping changes people were more excited about.
It was incredible to see the consensus between stakeholders that don't agree on little things when we did something really big and complicated. And again, I think it's just, you can see the difference that it will actually make. And then some of the smaller quibbles just don't matter as much.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, somehow we are close to the end of our conversation here. And so you actually have been bringing up a lot of things that I think we've heard throughout the season, especially when you're talking about sort of generational trauma and the impacts that it has, not just on the person, but maybe future people. So one thing that we've sort of anchored this season is, what's the one thing about trauma or healing that the public might not know or understand? And from your perspective, they did understand it, it would change.
I think if more people understood how much we have to benefit from the hard work of healing after harm, people would be excited about doing that. As I said, oftentimes when we're legislating or writing very quickly, the easiest draft is to say, we're mad this happened, we're going to punish it, this is what the punishment is going to be for doing this thing. It's much harder to sit down and say, we're going to draw the lines where the lines should be drawn, account for the nuance, give people a voice in the process along the way. But I think that people intuitively understand that that's how you get to the best outcome. And if more people were just able to apply that reasoning to the criminal legal system context, I think we'd be in a much better position.
I feel like you've spent your career trying to tackle the ways that, you know, racism and sexism and all forms of oppression really keep us from healing, and how we've set up all of these systems in the name of justice that really aren't accomplishing that. And you've said something to me, I should say for our listeners, Patrice is also a board member, so she's technically my boss. And so we should own that. But you've been such a great support to the work that we do at Volare, and you've taught me this idea that's really relevant in trauma education, that all pain is pain. And when we don't tackle really hard things that keep us from progress, like racism and all of the forms of oppression that sort of drive these inequities, we're actually not recognizing all pain is equal. And that's what trauma education forces us to do, right? It's not to minimize the pain that someone's causing because something in society has structured an othering around their experience and what sort of led to their life being at the place it's at. So I just want to express gratitude to the nuance that you've kind of infused into my own lens as a leader and into the work that we do at Volare. And I know that you now are in NYU and we miss you dearly, but we're just so incredibly proud of the work that you continue to do there and appreciate your time and the stuff that you work on every single day. But of course, giving us a little bit of insight into what that journey has been like for you, Patrice. So thanks so much for joining us today.
It's mutual. Thank you for all the work you're doing and for letting me join you.
Yeah, we're so grateful for the folks that are listening in and joining us here for season 4 of Traumatize. Of course, as you listen, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the Traumatized podcast wherever you listen.
This episode of Traumatize is over, but this podcast is just one of our many resources. Volare welcomes all survivors of crime and their supporters. So please visit us at volare-empowers.org to learn more about how to access our trauma education and how to partner with us to create empowering experiences for survivors.